Today's topic is the prosecution of public corruption. We really have a terrific panel composed of people who have been prosecutors, defense counsel, legislative and academic advisors. Each panelist is going to have about 8 minutes, that's tops, for opening remarks, followed by an interchange between the panelists, and then a question and answer period with the audience. I have reserved, or perhaps usurped, the authority to interrupt the panelists at any time and ask a question if there's not enough controversy going on here. Two small notes. In light of my judicial responsibilities, I've asked the panelists not to discuss any case that's currently pending in the D.C. Circuit or in the D.C. District Court, and I ask the audience to follow the same rule with respect to specific cases, obviously not kind of cases. And in light of Alice Fisher's former role as Chief of the Criminal Division, she's not going to be able herself to address any specific cases that were pending during her time at the Department of Justice. So, without further ado, let me introduce you to our panel. Bob Trout, on the far right over here, is a partner in the firm of Trout and Kacharis. His practice consists of complex commercial litigation, white-collar criminal defense, and the Defense of Administrative Agency enforcement actions. He began his career at the Department of Justice, where he served for 2 years in the criminal division, followed by 4 years as an assistant United States attorney in Baltimore, Maryland. Mr. Trout served as associate deputy independent counsel in 1995 to 96. In 1996, he opened his own firm, which assumed its current name when Plato Kacharis joined in 2005. He's a graduate of the University of Virginia Law School, fellow of the American College of Trial Lawyers. He's listed in numerous publications, including one called Super Lawyers. I'm sure this is a very serious organization, but it sounds like a great comic book to me. Many years ago, Bob and I had the pleasure of trying a complex financial fraud case against each other, if trying a case almost every single day from May until September can be described as a pleasure. Dan Reedy. Dan is the next person over here. He is the partner in charge at the Chicago office of Jones Day, dividing his time between criminal and civil litigation. He served as an assistant U.S. attorney in Chicago for 10 years and as first assistant for 3 years. During that time, he was a lead prosecutor in the Greylord investigation. It's an investigation of judicial corruption. He personally prosecuted a number of judges, lawyers, and court personnel, just the mention of which makes me nervous. He also handled numerous cases of public corruption outside the judicial sphere, including the conviction of a Chicago alderman. Dan is a graduate of the University of Michigan Law School. Following law school, he served as a clerk for Judge Cummings of the Seventh Circuit. He's a fellow of the American College of Trial Lawyers, and he is a member of the ABA's criminal justice and litigation sections. To my left over here is John Baker. John is the Dale E. Bennett Professor of Law at Louisiana State University. Since 1999, he has also served as invited professor at the University of Lyon in France. Sounds like a very good gig to me.
That's great.
He teaches con law, criminal law, and alternative dispute resolution. He regularly argues in federal court and has taught a number of short courses on separation of powers with Justice Scalia. Professor Baker received his JD from the University of Michigan and PhD from the University of London. Following law school, he served as a law clerk for a federal district judge and as an assistant district attorney in New Orleans before joining LSU in 1975. He has been a consultant to the Justice Department, the U.S. Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Separation of Powers, the Office of Planning in the White House, and USAID. And on the far left over here is Alice Fisher. She is the global co-chair of Latham & Watkins White Collar and Government Investigations Practice Group, where she specializes in white-collar criminal and internal investigations. From 2005 to 2008, Alice served as the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Criminal Division of the United States Department of Justice. She also chaired the National Procurement Fraud Task Force, supervised the Medicare Task Force, and served the Medicare Fraud Task Force, and served as a member of the President's Corporate Fraud Task Force. Alice received her JD from Catholic University. Before her most recent government service, she had been a litigation partner at Latham and held other positions at the Department of Justice, including Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Criminal Division and Deputy Special Counsel to a U.S. Senate Special Committee. Today's topic is the prosecution of public corruption. And we'll begin with Professor Baker. With Bob Trout. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Judge Garland. It's a pleasure to be here. I would like to talk today, and I think probably others will as well, about a statute which, from my point of view, surely is one of the most insidious statutes in the criminal code. And I'm speaking about the so-called honest services statute. Probably most of you or many of you are familiar with this statute, but for those who aren't, let me begin briefly at the beginning. The use of the mail or wire in furtherance of a scheme or artifice to defraud is a 20-year felony. Now, the mail fraud statute and the wire fraud statute have been around for decades. And before 1987, there were a number of courts that had interpreted these statutes as a scheme to defraud persons out of intangible rights, such as the right to honest services of government officials, as being an appropriate and authorized use of the statute. It was not frequently used, but there was this theory that was embodied in the case law dating back many years. In 1987, the Supreme Court, presumably disapproving of this expansive and vague and open-ended language, struck it down. They basically said that the mail fraud statute only reached schemes or artifice to defraud people out of money or property. And they said, if Congress desires to go further, it must speak more clearly on this. And Congress immediately did. And in 1988, I believe it was, they passed 18 U.S.C. 1346. And here is the entire text of the statute. For purposes of this chapter, the term scheme or artifice to defraud includes a scheme or artifice to deprive another of the intangible right of honest services, period, full stop. This is an extraordinarily powerful weapon for the government to use in bringing federal corruption prosecutions. For the past 20 years, the courts have been struggling with how to interpret this and to figure out what this vague and open-ended statute means, and worse for individual defendants, they too have been struggling to figure it out. The obvious problem that the courts recognize but continue to allow to exist is that basically it allows the prosecutors the discretion to kind of make it up as they go along and to prosecute whatever it is that they think is culpable behavior. It really has become the weapon of choice in federal criminal corruption prosecutions. Let me give you a couple of two or three examples of the way this statute has been used. This is a case that was reported July 21, 2008. We're now 20 years into this new statute. It was in the District of Minnesota, and this prosecution was allowed to go forward. Two police officers were charged with honest services fraud after they took money from a crime scene but returned it when they suspected they were under investigation. The district court, while upholding the prosecution and denying the motion to dismiss, noted how broad the government's theory of the case was. Quote, it argues that even if the jury rejects its theory and concludes that the defendants did not steal money on November 3, 2004, the jury could nevertheless convict the defendants of wire fraud based upon violations of, for example, a rule of conduct of the St. Paul Police Department requiring officers to report that they are under investigation, or a rule of conduct of the Ramsey County Sheriff's Department requiring deputies not to conduct themselves in a manner that, quote, adversely affects the morale or efficiency of the department, unquote. Or a Minnesota statute requiring peace officers to leave a receipt for items taken during the execution of a search warrant. In short, the government has charged this case about as broadly as possible, apparently hoping to make new law or hoping that if the jury rejects the court's contention, the jury will still convict the defendants of something. In the Seventh Circuit, this is the case of United States versus Thompson. It was decided in 2007. The Second Circuit in this case reversed the honest services conviction of a state official that was based on the following facts. The official had awarded a state contract to a company that was favored by the governor, but had not received the highest rating from the selection board, and the official subsequently received a raise. The court noted that treating an incorrect application of state procurement law as a, quote, misuse of office, unquote, and a raise as a, quote, private gain, unquote, would land us back in the soup. Once again, simple violations of administrative rules would become crimes. Writing for the court, Judge Easterbrook concluded, quote, this prosecution, which led to the conviction and imprisonment of a civil servant for conduct that, as far as this record shows, was designed to pursue the public interest as the employee understood it, may well induce Congress to take another look at the wisdom of enacting ambulatory criminal prosecution prohibitions. In United States versus Giffen, prosecutors in the Southern District of New York used the Honest Services Statute to prosecute someone for bribing foreign officials, arguing that the defendant had deprived the citizens of Kazakhstan of the honest services of their public officials. The district court happily said no. If such bribery were covered by the statute, it would be unconstitutionally void for vagueness. And in United States versus Murphy, a county political party chairman was prosecuted for depriving the county of his honest services. This is a private official who is a party official, not a public official. He was also prosecuted for honest services fraud, and it took the Court of Appeals to overturn that conviction. And in United States versus Chabinsky, in the First Circuit, an IRS agent had looked at files that he wasn't supposed to look at, and he was convicted. And the First Circuit reversed his conviction for honest services fraud, finding that his conduct was outside the core of honest services precedents, and that he was never advised that violating the IRS rule, all it was a rule, not to look at somebody's files, that would constitute a basis for anything other than firing. These convictions, bear in mind, I mean, what we're talking about is individuals who were prosecuted, who were convicted. In some cases, they spent time in prison until the Court of Appeals reverse their conviction. I currently represent William Jefferson, and the indictment in the Jefferson case illustrates one of the problems here. They set out the oath of office of a member of Congress. They set out various rules of conduct, in House rules of conduct, and it is very clear that what the intent is going to be is they will marry up the honest services statute with these House rules of conduct with the object of hoping that the jury will simply decide that any sort of deviation from the House rules will be grounds for finding of guilt on under the honest services statute. Let me conclude simply by quoting from a concurring opinion in another case. This was actually not a public corruption case, but it was an honest services case in a commercial context. This is in the Fifth Circuit, the so-called Nigerian barge prosecution. Judge DeMoss concurring writes as follows. The defendants have raised here a constitutional challenge to Section 1346, and in my view, the panel should now address that issue. Years of review of the application of Section 1346 to varied facts persuade me that the constitutionality of 1346 may well be in serious doubt. A federal criminal statute must define the crime with sufficient definiteness that ordinary people can understand what conduct is prohibited and in a manner that does not encourage arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement. Section 1346's text is undeniably vague and ambiguous, and is subject to the wide variation in application by lower courts. Rather than address the larger constitutional problems with this statute, which would provide clarity to Congress, prosecutors in the lower courts, the circuit courts, have instead only clouded the meaning of 1346 by repeatedly resolving the ambiguities of the statute's text via judicially created definitions and limitations. Our court and our sister circuits end up doing precisely what most would say we lack the constitutional power to do, that is, define what constitutes criminal conduct on an ex post facto and ad hoc basis. Congress should repair this statute that, in my mind, fails to provide the requisite minimal guidelines to govern law enforcement. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob. Dan?
Well, I'm also going to talk about honest services in a way that you might actually think that Bob and I had carefully coordinated, but it turns out to be an accident. Because one of the ways I want to look at the honest services problem, and the reason I see it as a problem that this organization might be interested in, is because of what Bob's pointing out, which is that there is a significant danger, I think, under the way the law exists, that aggressive prosecutors in the federal system can enforce sort of their own mores as to what good government is. And they can make that into a federal crime in a way that I think steps a long way away from bribery, as I knew it. And I confess, and as the judge has already indicated, I spent more than a decade as a prosecutor in Chicago, where, as some of you may have heard, we do have the odd corrupt public official from decade to decade that we stagger across, and it was hard not to trip over them coming out of the building sometimes. And I spent, you know, about 11 years literally trying to expand the mail fraud statute in every way, and these were all – I left the office just before McNally was decided in 1987, and so I really spent a long time trying to expand the mail fraud statute when it didn't say anything about honest and faithful services, and where later the Supreme Court, quite rightly, I think, said, you know what, this just isn't here. People can't tell what a crime is and unless Congress fixes it, which, as Bob pointed out, they did in a year. But and Bob's rightly pointed out to you a number of cases that the courts have taken up and said, look, these prosecutors are going too far. This is crazy talk. We can't let them do this. My focus is going to be on a couple of cases, and one in particular, where the courts have said, yeah, the prosecutor's right. You can do this. And because that's more scary to me. I think Bob's given you the examples of where they've overreached maybe and had their wrists slapped, and I would be prepared to get a little bit concerned about places where at least one can argue there's overreaching and they haven't had their wrists slapped. One of the principles, and this is particular to many circuits, but in the Seventh Circuit it's been talked about quite a bit because of all the cases coming out of Chicago. One of the principles that they have put in to kind of control this notion of what does honest and faithful services mean, so that it can't be just every rule violation, is that there's a concept now grafted onto the law that says there must be some private gain. And that's very strongly held in the Seventh Circuit. It's a little fuzzier a couple other places. And so when you look at whether or not somebody's violated a rule or done something that's not regarded as good government, you can't necessarily turn that into a federal crime under the mail fraud statute, honest and faithful services, simply by saying, you know, you violated some underlying state statute or some ordinance of the city or some principle of the Constitution of the state you're in or any other sort of reference, and you can't necessarily turn that into a prosecution without establishing that you did so in connection with private gain. So I contrast it sort of this way. If you have a public official who is about to hire someone to a non-discretionary position, not a policy-level position, but just to a position in government, and this official, let's say it's sort of the hiring official, works for some elected official, but he's the hiring official. This hiring official says, I'm going to hire somebody, but I'm going to hire whoever pays me the most money. And somebody pays him a lot of money, and he hires him into a job inside the municipality or whatever it is. And somebody comes along and says, you know what, we think the citizenry has been deprived of this public official hiring official's honest and faithful services because this person's honest and faithful services obligation to do the right thing and hire the right person has been subverted by the fact that he's been given money and therefore experienced the magic private gain. I don't think anybody here can really have a problem with that. I mean, beyond some global problems of the federal government doing anything at all with respect to state officials. So that one, I think, is straightforward, where in the Seventh Circuit, at least, and this is a case called Sorich, which involved our current Mayor Daley's, and you may have trouble keeping track of the eons in which we're represented by a mayor called Daley, but we now have one that has outserved his father's length of time. And he has a had a guy who was basically in charge of political patronage for the government. And political patronage and civil service hiring is improper in Illinois. And we, in addition to that, the city of Chicago has entered into a consent decree that says they won't do political hiring, one brought by some private lawyers. And so there are reasons why you're not supposed to be doing patronage hiring. So the hiring official in this case did, in fact, do political hiring and did some things, you know, moved exams around, changed results, did things in order to allow people who were part of the system or cronies of the political system that he was involved in to get jobs. And so the federal government walked in and prosecuted him and several people who worked with him for honest and services mail fraud, arguing that he had deprived the citizens of his honest and faithful services because he had disobeyed this court order and disobeyed these civil service laws, et cetera, and caused people to be hired and favored because they had some political patronage. In this case, though, unlike my first example and the sort of classic example, there was no thought or indication that this hiring guy, this political patronage chief, if you like, had gotten any money for this. Not a nickel, not a dime, no money whatsoever in doing this. And so the case was argued into the Seventh Circuit, actually by my partner, John Klein, out of our San Francisco office, to say, look, this does not pass the private gain test. The limit you have on using this honest and faithful services notion is you have to have private gain. And the Seventh Circuit decided that there was private gain because the person hired had received a job, and that a job obviously has sort of a property quality to it, involves a salary, and so that person had received a job. And this sort of stretch for me, I mean, I've got no problem with my private gain in the first example that I gave you, but this stretch to private gain troubles me, because in all kinds of decisions like this, there's going to be somebody who gets a job, somebody, some contractor who gets something. And what the Seventh Circuit held is that none of the conspirators need be the people who fixed the records or decided to make, you know, give this guy the job or put him ahead of some more qualified applicant. None of the conspirators had anything to do with the private gain. The person getting the job had no idea whatsoever that anybody was fiddling with the records or tearing up exams or putting one person at the top of the pile over another. No idea whatsoever. Couldn't be proven. Couldn't be shown. In fact, was not the case. These people who were getting the jobs didn't know that was going on. So the private gain is completely away from the conspiracy to violate the rules. And one of the things I've seen, because I represented some witnesses and some other people in these cases, at least in the Seventh Circuit, is I'm now having witnesses questioned about literally things like, well, did you hire the best person? I mean, was this the best person for the job? Was this the very best person who could have gotten this job? And so I'm able to imagine a situation where there's an internal memo that says something like, I want to hire so-and-so to fill a job. We have two candidates. Each are outstanding. Both are equally well qualified. Everybody agrees that they're really good. Probably, you know, this guy is 52% better and this guy is 48%, but the Mr. 48% has always been a big supporter of our election efforts, et cetera, and so let's give it to 48%. They're both very qualified. As far as I can tell, that's a violation of the Sorosh principles of honest and faithful services. That would be enough to – that's a political hiring act, and it would be enforceable by federal criminal prosecution, at least in the Seventh Circuit. I'm troubled by it a little bit. I don't know that I have all the answers on it, but I find it a little troubling that, you know, we always have issues with prosecutorial discretion. You know, all of us who've been prosecutors up here, and that's, I think, everybody, have, you know, been in the world where you use that discretion, and obviously you get people using it the right way, things turn out right, and people using it not quite the right way, and you see some of the cases that Bob's talked about. But I'm concerned that you get some young prosecutors with sort of a moral rectitude about what good government is. You can always go in and find some sort of statute or principle inside a state that says, you know, you should always do the right thing, always hire the best people, always do this. And if you have that and somebody gets a job, you've now got the elements of honest and faithful services mail fraud. So I'm concerned about that aspect of this. I'm concerned about what it does about the federal government being able to regulate good government inside state, municipal, and for that matter, the South Palos Township Mosquito Abatement District, all of which would be able to be applied for this. So that's one issue I raised for you.
Before I pass on the baton, since it may be a while before we get to Alice, maybe the only one on the panel at least supporting the statute. Let me just ask Dan a question. On your construct of private gain, with respect to a federal official, is there anything other than complete overlap between the honest services statute and, for example, the gratuity statute. That is, does honest services get any reach anything that gratuity doesn't?
Yeah, I think so. In fact, in my hiring example, the gratuity statute strikes out. In other words, in the storage case itself.
On what you want, that on your proposal, that be limited to payment, wouldn't that make at least for federal officials complete overlap?
I think, depending on just how it worked out, for example, I would be willing to put up with any conspirator getting the money, even the non-public official. If you and I are working together and you get the money but you're not a public official, I am, we probably have trouble with the gratuity statute. But I'd be okay with honest and faithful services saying that as long as it's a conspirator who's fiddling with the system and violating the procedures, who gets the money. So I suspect we could come up with a couple areas that would be just not quite coextensive with the gratuity statute.
Okay. And Bob, is there a use of this statute that you would like as compared to the ones that you've described that you don't like?
There's really nothing about this statute that I like. But let me add this. Going back to your gratuities example, I agree with the point that you're making, but here you have a specific gratuity statute, and it provides for a two-year maximum penalty. You take this amorphous statute, apply it to gratuities, and all of a sudden you've got a 20-year maximum penalty. There's just something wrong with this.
Okay. We'll pass on. Professor Baker.
I hope all of you have enjoyed your lunch. I want to begin by making a connection between this lunch and public corruption. This may not seem to be an obvious connection, but the judge has just assisted me by mentioning the gratuity statute. Thanks to the U.S. Supreme Court decision in U.S. versus Sun Diamond Growers, Judge Garland is able to be our guest today without violating the illegal gratuity statute.
Well, it's actually thanks to a D.C. Circuit opinion that I lost, 7-5.
Well, I'll stick with the Supremes as ultimate authority on this one. In any event, if it had been up to the district court and the Department of Justice, that would not have been the case. Now, for those who are out there in our C-SPAN audience and who think that this might be really an exaggeration, let me just briefly talk about this case and quote a little bit from Justice Scalia's opinion. This is a case involving former Secretary of Agriculture Mike Espy, and the court was only dealing with one of the charges against him here. But as to this charge, trade groups that represented farmers had given him a number of gifts, but there was no specific public act that he had taken or was about to take that was in any way related to it. So that really the issue was, is it a violation of the Gratuities Act, illegal gratuity statute, simply to give a gift to someone in a public position? Now, the court fortunately held no, that something more is required. But I want to read to you, and by first mentioning that the examples that Justice Scalia gave, he said, if the Department of Justice position were accepted, then these nominal gifts that sports teams and others give to the president when they visit the White House, that would be a violation of the illegal gratuity statutes. Of course, he could have mentioned but didn't mention the gifts that are given to Supreme Court justices when they go around and give speeches. I'm sure, though, he had that in mind. And he gives these examples, and he says this, that these examples are not fanciful is demonstrated by the fact the counsel for the United States maintained at oral argument that a group of farmers would violate the statute by providing a complimentary lunch for the Secretary of Agriculture when nothing in particular was at stake. Now, how can we get to such a position that the department takes, when you follow the logic of it, an absurd result? And, of course, the response will be, and probably Alice will give it to me, is that, of course, the Department of Justice would never do something so stupid. Not if it were visible, I agree. If it made the papers, they would not do the work. I agree. But what happens in a lot of these cases, and I would say it's true with Congressman Bill Jefferson, they take something that really looks bad and may well be bad and may well be criminal. Then they pile on all of these other charges, and they stretch it as far as they can. And people don't look at those. They look at the one thing. Then they set precedents, either by plea or conviction, that extend and are used in plea bargaining and expansive purposes to other less notable defendants. We've got three problems that I want to discuss, although we could discuss a lot more. One is the expansion of the statute issue that was addressed somewhat already. Two, which is a violation of separation of powers. Two is the federalism issue. And three is the very distorted view of good government that unfortunately is at the base of the Department of Justice career prosecution people. Well-intended, but terribly misguided. One, statutory interpretation is not just a violation of void for vagueness. It's a violation of separation of powers that was alluded to in Judge DeMoss's concurring opinion. As Chief Justice Marshall said in the Wiltberger case, the reason for strict construction in the area of criminal law is because the courts have no common law power to create the law. That is Congress's responsibility. The other thing about broad expansion is that it erodes, if not completely effectively eliminates, mental elements in many of the crimes, and this means that we are convicting people who are fundamentally innocent. They may be at fault, but not in a criminal sense, fault. There are a lot of innocent people in federal jails. Nobody wants to admit that, but that's really true. Two, federalism. You know, there is a role for the federal government rooting out corruption. I just wish it would focus on the federal government. There's plenty to do there. The other day it was reported that the IRS had given out $1 billion in fraud payments. They didn't commit the fraud. They were just incompetent. But there were people taking these fraudulent payments. They said, we don't have enough resources to do anything about it. Well, then why are you off chasing all these state cases? Well, wait a minute. State cases are really important. Why are state cases important? Because good government. Why? What kinds of cases are they taking? I want a case in the Fifth Circuit, consulted on a similar issue in the Sixth Circuit where we want it. They took a violation of a state campaign finance statute and under, quote, the salary theory, claimed that this violated the mail fraud statute without the honest services in the Fifth Circuit and in the Sixth Circuit, both general mail fraud and honest services. Here's what the theory was and the property was. If he got elected by deceiving the people by filing a false report, the salary he got was the property he stole. That's very interesting. Both circuits rejected it, said it was completely ridiculous. Had it been allowed, then virtually every member of Congress who has any kind of campaign finance violation would be guilty of mail fraud. Maybe they should have upheld it. And then... The problem that we're dealing with goes back to roughly 1968 and President Nixon and his Law and Order campaign. I'll read to you just a little bit from Judge John Noonan of the Ninth Circuit, what he wrote on his great treatise on bribes, the history of corruption, went back when he was a professor. He said, quote, employing means that would have been criminal if employed by private persons, the executive branch was in a position to supervise every government official in the country, from traffic court clerks to senators. The judicial branch was in a position to approve or disapprove this supervision. Enforcers of this anti-bribery ethic by the criminal law, these prosecutors, judges, had become the guardians of honest government. I suggest to you that they've got a very distorted idea of honest government. Why? Our Constitution, as explained in the Federalist Papers, is a treatise on honest government. How are you going to get it? You're going to get it through federalism and separation of powers. I don't care how well-intended people in the Justice Department are, and I assume that. After all, I got a sister working in the criminal division. I assume that. But there is also the corruption of power. And that's what separation of powers is designed to do, is to stop that. As Madison explained in Federalist 10, what is a legislature but a series of conflicts of interest? Lawyers cannot transfer their conflict of interest ethic from the courtroom to the legislature. What's the solution? Either we can have independent statesmen, judges, outsiders to decide it, and of course, who will watch them? Or we can structure power in such a way that it protects it. So every time in the name of good government that you violate constitutional restrictions, you are corrupting good government. Thank you very much.
Before I give Alice a chance for rebuttal, let me ask John the same question that I asked Dan and Bob. So you say that an improper, I take it, construction of the honest services statute would constitute a violation of separation of powers. So my question is, what is a proper construction, keeping in mind that in McNally, the court said it had to involve the mail fraud statute had to involve money or property rights, and the very next year, Congress expressly rejecting McNally said, no, it doesn't. It extends to an intangible right of honest services. Given that express statutory text, reading it as a strict constructionist, is there any element of the honest services statute that you think leads to an appropriate prosecution?
No, it's an improper statute for this reason. Per those who drafted it, as reflected in opinions and elsewhere, the purpose of it was to codify the law as it existed. The problem was the interpretation from circuit to circuit differed. You cannot draft a law for the United States that has a law for different circuits. So by their very admission that the statute was intended to have different laws in different circuits, it's not a law. A law has to be of general application. The whole thing is completely invalid.
So you would ask the unelected judiciary then to strike down the statute passed by the elected legislature, and that would not violate the separation of powers?
Absolutely not. When Congress goes beyond its proper authority, and its proper authority is to draft a statute, this is not a statute that is a proper statute.
So what should the court do when confronted with a prosecution under that statute?
They've got various grounds to throw that statute out.
So they should.
Look, several cases ago, and I can't remember the name of the case, Supreme Court Justice Scalia said, and I've tracked this in an article on the history of the mail fraud statute, the mail fraud statute was enacted to prevent fraud in the mails. As Justice Scalia pointed out, the way it has been construed by courts is wrong in having it mail and fraud. That's a totally different construction. And the Congress has the obligation to draft statutes that give proper notice to what violates the law. You've heard it from our other two speakers. What we have in these statutes gives nobody notice of what violates federal law.
Okay, let me pass on to Alice. Can you think, Alice, of any prosecution under this statute that would be appropriate? Without being specific as to any of those that you approved.
Can I think of any prosecution that would be appropriate under
this
statute?
I can
think of several prosecutions that would be appropriate.
I thought that might be the answer.
Yeah, so if I could just step back for a second, because there's been some things said, and I just want to make it clear, because I do think that the Department of Justice and their public corruption prosecutions have gotten a real bum rap over the past years, and this panel is felt free to even say, you know, that they're misguided and they have a distorted view of good government. And I just want to say, not my experience at all. The Department of Justice and the prosecutors there, you know, spend every day trying to work to uphold the public trust. And while they struggle with statutes such as the honest services statutes, they struggle with them internally. And you might not see them, and you might not see that deliberation, but They live in a world when they're prosecuting public corruption, and I know, Dan, you can appreciate this, and maybe you can, Professor, and I think Bob can. They're damned if you do and damned if you don't. You know, they make a decision on a public corruption matter, and lots of people are unhappy at the end of the day, and they are constantly attacked more than any other set of prosecutors, I think, The ones that go after public corruption have to have the thickest skins, but they are constantly attacked for their motives, their competence, et cetera. And so I just want to start by taking a step back and saying, not my experience. These are very committed people that are working hard to really do their job and uphold the public trust. They have brought a lot of great cases. You ask about the Honest Services case. I think the Abramoff line of cases here in Washington is a use of the Honest Services case that hasn't been discussed, but it relates to federal, and it kind of goes on to the First Circuit Woodward and Sawyer cases where there's a stream of benefits that are given and a stream of official acts that are done at the end of the day, and that's a violation of Honest Services. So if you, for example, look at the case where Congressman Ney from Ohio pled guilty, it's closed so I can talk about it, there were a stream of things given to Congressman Ney by lobbyists, Mr. Abramoff and others, that included, you know, thousands of dollars of trips to Scotland, trips to Lake George, vacations, thousands of dollars of meals and drinks and sporting events and things like that. And in return, you know, they got Congressman Ney, and he pled guilty to this, to agree to oppose or favor legislation, oppose or favor licenses in the executive branch, and on and on, and the plea agreement will set it out. And that's, you know, that's an Honest Services case that, you know, needs to be stood behind and is consistent with the law, even at the state level. So the Woodward and Sawyer cases in the First Circuit, it's a state representative where that theory of stream of benefits per stream of official acts was upheld. To try to address some of the topics that have already been raised here, I think Judge Garland said, with the Honest Services statute, this is a statute that Congress passed. It was struck down by the courts in the McNally decision, and within a year it was passed again. So Congress has mandated, when we talk about separation of powers, Congress has mandated this statute, and it's the Department of Justice's role to uphold and enforce the law. The Department of Justice can't just say, well, we're not going to use it. I know that Congress thought it was a nifty little statute for us to use at the appropriate times, but we're just not going to enforce it. No, the Department of Justice prosecutors can't make that decision not to enforce a law or take forward the responsibility that Congress has given them. I do think that this is a statute that should be used very carefully and very cautiously. And so, you know, probably you're hearing a debate that some people think the statute should go away completely, and others think that prosecutors haven't been using it judiciously. I do think that there needs to be a constant and increased awareness of the use to the statute, and it's one that you need to be very careful about and that, you know, we talked a lot about when I was at the Department of Justice. I know this is being great for my defense career now. You know, so I will agree with regard to how it's been used and how far it's going, both in the public sector and in the private sector. There are many appropriate cases for it, but you need to think twice about it. On the state issue, whether the federal government should ever go in and prosecute public corruption that's happening at the state level, again, there can be a debate about whether that's ever appropriate. But the practical reality is that Congress has passed statutes directly targeted at this, and it's the department's responsibility to do it. And lots of times states will not prosecute those cases. And they may come to the federal government or the FBI and say, please help us out here. Now, it may be for very benign reasons, like resources. It may be for other reasons at the other end, dealing with conflict of interest where they can't actually appropriately prosecute violations of their public corruption laws or the federal laws. So in that regard, I think, again, there have been many prosecutions with regard to state corruption, but, you know, they are appropriate because of the way that our system is brought up and the overall importance of upholding the trust in public work and public service.
Mr. Baker, you appear to be jumping out of your chair to respond. Go ahead.
You know, this business about Congress passing, very few people know that the Department of Justice has, as far as I know, it still goes on, but it certainly went on for a long time. They assign an attorney to the Judiciary Committee. That's a violation of separation of powers. It was recognized by the Bush administration. It attempted to withdraw these detailees because of the concern about separation of powers. Senator Grassley put on a rider and a bill that prevented the White House from withdrawing those attorneys. The reality is, when it comes to separation of powers on the criminal issue, there is no effective separation of powers. I quoted from Judge John Noonan showing what the federal courts had done for a long time in union with the Justice Department. Remember, we have a president who says he's against activist judges, except when it comes to their stretching the law in criminal cases. Look at the Arthur Anderson case that was overturned 9-0 in the Supreme Court. You look at the charge in that case and what the trial judge accepted from the Department of Justice attorneys. It was outrageous. So there is no constituency that blocks anything that goes through the Congress that has to do with criminal law on the substantive side. The ACLU doesn't oppose it. They're concerned about the death penalty and procedural issues. Our system does not work when it comes to refining criminal law, and the federal courts, except at the Supreme Court level, and some exceptions like the Fifth Circuit, is not very attuned to, in fact, dealing with structural constitutional issues and making sure that there is adequate notice and restriction on federal prosecutorial power. In no way do I question the motives of prosecutors, but you can be well-intended and nevertheless be terribly misguided.
John, just to follow up on another point that Alice raised, is your position that federal prosecutors should have no involvement in state corruption issues?
They have to find a particular statute that justifies their getting involved. You know, I'd love them to get more involved in voter fraud cases, but my experience in trying to get U.S. attorneys to look into a voter fraud case when I was involved in a recount, no interest in that kind of thing. You know, there is plenty that federal prosecutors could do, but the reality is they have so much they could do that they can only prosecute a small fraction of the crime that really exists out there. So how do they pick out the crime? Well, if it makes it into the newspaper, you can be guaranteed that you are going to be the subject of a grand jury investigation.
Dan, as somebody, when you were a prosecutor, did quite an intensive investigation of a state judicial system. Are you in agreement that the federal government has no business investigating state judicial systems?
No, I'm not. And I think it's, you know, it's an issue worthy of debate from a federal standpoint, but I don't have any problem with the federal government, you know, prosecuting it. And I have no problem with honest and faithful mail fraud services cases where they involve what I believe is, you know, sort of a straightforward bribe where the private gain goes to the public official, as I think I indicated. So I'd be separated from the professor there and closer to Alice. And I do think, you know, it's a tough world, and we, you know, we literally join in that, going back and forth with the Office of Legal Counsel when we were trying to get our undercover project going in the Graylord cases, because we were bugging judges' chambers, we were putting funny cases in the system. You'd be happy to know that I had to meet with Judge Webster about five times to get him to approve a bug that we put in a judge chambers, because he couldn't understand it. He was thinking of the Eighth Circuit, and I was trying to tell him about a room that you go through to go to the washroom at 26th and California in Chicago. But in any event, there's a lot of issues that come up when you're doing those kinds of things. But I think that, Congress, you know, whether properly motivated or properly separated or not, I don't know. They clearly think that we ought to have an honest and faithful services way to do this, where a federal government can prosecute local officials. And, you know, I guess I'm partly driven by my experience in Chicago. You know, for many years it would have been extremely difficult from a resource standpoint, from a political independence standpoint. If the federal government were not prosecuting corrupt public officials in Chicago for the last 30 years or so, I don't know exactly what would have been happening there. Maybe things would have gotten straightened out on the state side, but it would have taken virtually a revolution.
John, what do you say about this more generalized point? When you have a state system where the same party controls both the elected judiciary and the executive, and therefore the county attorney, I'm not particularly aiming at any particular state, but this happens obviously in a lot of places. And so there's no internal
incentive to be investigating corruption, and maybe, in fact, it's the corruption that continues that party in office, because, as they say, money is the mother's milk of politics.
Do you think
the federal government has no responsibility in those circumstances?
Well, first of all, as Dan noted, he was from Chicago. I'm from Louisiana, which automatically qualifies me as an expert in public corruption by manner of observing the place. It took us a number of years, but we finally got a reform governor, and, things are changing. The disadvantage of self-government is
But there were federal prosecutions.
And I'd be happy to talk about that if you give me a little bit of time. The original public corruption statute is the Gambling Act, the Lottery Act. It was aimed at only one state, Louisiana. Okay? After that, every other gambling act was aimed at Louisiana, and I sat through the test trial of the Gambling Devices Act in 1969. And the justification was, we're going to get organized crime going into the states. Well, guess what? The jury acquitted Bally, the organized crime supposed figure, corporation. All the locals who were guilty, clearly, of a misdemeanor, all got federal felonies. Now, when you draft a statute, if this particular state wants to make gambling legal or illegal, wants to make it a felony or misdemeanor, that's a choice of the citizens. To have people from other states using the federal government coming in and saying, look, we think you should have a different culture here, and we're going to change it. I think that's totally inappropriate under our system. The solution is one given us to in the Federalist Papers. You basically isolate that state and you force them to take their own responsibility. And if they're going to live with a third world government, that's their problem. Until it affects other states. When it affects other states, then the federal government, through the Commerce Clause, has a legitimate authority to go in there. But when you talk about sending the federal government in to prosecute local drainage districts, that has no effect on other states. It may offend you that there's corruption in that state. That's a self-government problem. If people are going to put up with corruption, they're going to suffer from it. Louisiana has suffered from it. We have an outpouring of population. We're going to pay the price. One of the things that I found in working for AID is that around the world, it has been discovered that corruption is directly proportional to the size of the percentage of the economy controlled by government. In our state, the economy is heavily controlled by government. In other states like Chicago, where you have corruption in the city, you also have a free market that balances that. If you want to fight public corruption, follow what the founders talked about. The more you give out federal monies, you're going to get more public corruption.
I know Alice is going to want to respond to that, but let me give Bob a chance if he has a view on this.
On the federalism issue, I can very easily imagine a situation where under state precedent and state law, a certain conduct has been determined to be not something that the state views as criminal. And yet that same conduct, under interpretations of the Honest Services Statute, would be deemed to be criminal. And I'm not sure why it is that the federal government would have an interest in that circumstance in enforcing its view of how the state should behave when the state has already expressed its view that this shouldn't be a crime. This is okay. In the federal context, frankly, I think, and John probably knows more about this than I do, I think the early honest services cases were an effort to really go after bribery, state bribery, probably. When I was a new prosecutor and the new assistant U.S. attorney in Maryland, shortly after I joined, the government brought the Mandel prosecution. And I remember looking at the indictment. I wasn't remotely close to the prosecution team, but I remember getting the indictment, looking at it, and thought, they can do that? And sure enough, they could, and at the time, I thought that was very cool. But the reality is, the reality is that the impulse to push the envelope is part of the prosecutor's DNA. I mean, it's almost in the drinking water at the Department of Justice, and it's just the way it is. And yes, they are well-intentioned. I don't doubt that for a moment. They're wonderful professional prosecutors, and certainly the more experienced prosecutors understand the power that they have and presumably do not are more disciplined, let's put it that way, in exercising that power. But you do have, you know, there are many, many prosecutors out there, and they come in all shapes and sizes. And this I think, is a problem. And when you have a federal statute or you have a federal problem, why shouldn't there be specific federal criminal statutes that reach it? We have a bribery statute. We have a gratuity statute. We have federal conflict of interest statutes. Why aren't they enough? And what this statute is used to do, it's basically used to fill in all the gaps in a mushy sort of way when the prosecutor realizes the elements of the specific criminal statutes really can't be satisfied. Well, Bob, and that's my problem.
Yeah, but I take John's point to be further than that. That is, even in a situation where there is a state law against bribery and where there's a federal statute, the Hobbs Act or the mail fraud statute or anything else, I take his point to be it's still, as a general matter, not the federal government's business.
Right.
Do you agree with that, or are you only talking about situations where it's, you know, what you would describe as dubious as to whether it falls within the statute?
Well, I guess my view is that it depends on how you assess the importance of the federalism principles at stake here. If the idea is, well, if there's a smattering of federal funds that go to the state, that gives us the federal jurisdiction to charge in there and start regulating, and that's fine, and we want to upset the system in Chicago or upset the system in Maryland that existed at the time of the, you know, in the 70s at the time of Agnew and during that period, then that is, I think, I understand that, although I think you need to figure out a way to do it with a properly crafted statute. If, on the other hand, the federalism principles are first and foremost in your mind, then I think you would back off from that.
Okay, Alice, now let him have it.
I actually found two things that I agreed with the professor here. One, his comments about Louisiana. Two, his comment that where there's more money going out the door, there's more corruption. And it was never seen more by what happened after Katrina. Unfortunately, there was so much money going out from the federal government so quickly. And we set up a task force to look for corruption and fraud. And you would not believe the number of cases and the number of corruption that matters that we saw across the country.
Those were legitimate prosecutions.
Thank you.
If it's federal money, I don't have any problem with it. I don't have any problem with Commerce Clause if, in fact, you stick to what the statute actually says.
Okay. He also said something about voter fraud and the fact that not many voter fraud cases are prosecuted. I will state one thing about this. There was, and it gets into this issue between state and federal government. There was a vote buying case down in eastern Kentucky, my home state, that, you know, where corruption had gone on in elections for a long period of time, and finally there was some convictions. The federal government came in and helped and prosecuted those cases, and there were editorials in this just tiny little eastern Kentucky newspaper after the fact that were just thank you, because this would have never happened had the federal government not come in. And so there is a role, I think, for the federal government in certain states because of the conflicts of interest and because of the reasons that Dan had mentioned with regard to Chicago. So is it appropriate in every case? Probably not, and we wouldn't have the resources. The Department of Justice wouldn't have the resources to do it in every case. They have to prioritize and bring the right cases. There are even cases where U.S. attorney's offices recuse themselves because of conflict of interest and ask that Maine Justice or another U.S. attorney's office come in and prosecute those cases. But they're important, and they're important to move forward with them.
Dan promises some controversy.
Well, and I guess, I mean, I don't think there's much doubt that the professor is right that, you know, mail fraud or Hobbs Act are really sort of bootstrapped ways to take a state crime of bribery and use the federal government's power against them. And the reason why you can't just go write a statute, because if you went in and wrote a federal statute that said, you know, it covers local state bribery, you would, in fact, run up against a lot of federalism principles and possibly find yourself with an unconstitutional statute. And it clearly is a way of backing into it to use the mails. I mean, to say, okay, well, if it involves mail or an interstate wiring, therefore we now prosecute local bribery. I guess, you know, where I probably would part company with the professor and some of the people in the room is, you know, having looked at a situation, and not being a sociologist, I'll just go ahead and give you amateur sociology, in many of these cities that were extremely ethnic and then extremely covered by political machines, if you like, a lot of the Rust Belt, Newark was big, you know, obviously Chicago was big, a number of cities out in the east. There were similar sort of constructs down in the south, including Louisiana, where there were machines that were basically in charge of government. And the people that were in charge of government and had the ability to elect people and, you know, put on campaigns and give jobs and reward their people in every single way, they were in charge. And to say that, you know, the federal government, you know, should do nothing while some place operates as a cesspool out of federalism is an approach, and I understand and respect it. You know, if I were pulling, you know, pushing my chips onto something, I'd be okay with saying, you know, it's okay for the federal government because you've got a substantial number of citizens who do not like the way their government is going and who don't feel like they can fix it once you've got a substantially corrupt system going on around it. And I think that's where you saw the expansion of the mail fraud statute. That's where I was involved in expanding it, you know, back in the late 70s and 80s. And, you know, you can argue that bad situations make for bad federalism or whatever, but, you know, I was okay with it and remain okay with it.
Okay, let me, I promised the panel I would, well, okay, I threatened the panel that I would ask a hypothetical. This is not on the on a services statute, and it's not on federalism. This is a case involving a federal official or a federal officer anyway, and it involves a gratuity statute. So a guy walks into a bar.
Why the long face?
He meets a police detective who happens to be in Washington, D.C., so he's covered by the statute. The guy asks him to search a law enforcement-only database for the names, home addresses, and social security numbers of certain people who hold certain Virginia automobile license plates. That is, he gives the detective the license plate numbers and says, I want the home, the names, the addresses, social security numbers, and then he gives the detective cash. Then he gives the detective more cash after the detective searches the database and provides the information, and still more as an incentive so that the detective will determine whether a, quote, friend of the guy has an outstanding arrest warrant in New York. The guy, who happens to wear a gold Rolex, drives a leased Mercedes-Benz, will meet only at night at a local gas station with the detective and advises the detective, read between the lines, says that he, the guy, is a federal judge. So this federal judge says, I want this information because these, and this being C-SPAN, these expletive deleted people owe me a lot of money. The detective is wary. He doesn't know who the guy is. He uses a different officer's code to access the restricted database. He runs a license number on the so-called federal judge's own Mercedes and finds out that it comes back leased. Nonetheless, in the end, he takes the cash repeatedly and gives the judge, quote, the information that he asked. For these acts, a jury convicts the detective of accepting an illegal gratuity. Is, in fact, this a legal gratuity or any other bribery or gratuity crime? I ask the members of the panel.
My recollection is that it was thrown out by a higher court, yeah. Right? The conviction because of he was not using government property.
It wasn't right? An official act.
Not an official act.
Right. So to turn over my cards, this is a D.C. Circuit case. The hypothetical comes from my dissent, joined by five. Majority rule, seven, saying that it's not a crime. I don't want to argue whether it is a crime. The question is, should it be a crime? That is, if Congress could reach this by being more explicit in the statute, is this the kind of thing that we want as a federal crime or not? And I'll turn to John first.
Well, Congress, although it doesn't exercise its authority over D.C. the way it ought to, Congress has sovereignty over D.C. the way a state has over its own. So Congress's ability to enact legislation criminal in D.C. has to be analyzed completely differently.
Right, but I don't want you to think about it as a federalism question. Imagine this was an FBI agent or any other kind of government official at the Social Security Administration. Should it be a crime to take money to access a restricted database and provide information?
If it is a federal official and Congress wants to make it a crime, there's no problem.
Yeah. Bob, you have the same view?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the argument on the other side, and we're going to ask, well, we're slightly overdue for questions, so we'll ask everybody. The argument on the other side is this is just providing information, and that the line between providing this kind of information and the other kind of information is so slight that this could be criminalized, a lot of kinds of activity that you might not otherwise want criminalized.
But Congress didn't criminalize it specifically. You were asking, could Congress?
Yes. But you should. I'm asking, should Congress, not could.
That's a policy decision, and I'd vote for it if they want to do it.
Right.
But that's different from your dissent. I would have been with the majority.
I figured I'd lose that one. Okay, we now have about 15 or 20 minutes. Again, we've been instructed we must leave at 2 o'clock, so somebody has to tell me when it's 2 o'clock. There's a mic here, and where else is a mic? Somebody raise it for another one? I guess it's the only one. Mike Madigan promised to ask the first question. Come on, Mike. No, now he doesn't want to do it. Yeah, we got one. Come on up.
I'm John Shortino. I've been in AUSA for about 10 years. Would like to respond to two things. One, prosecutors are not hardwired to push the envelope. We don't want to prepare a case and get it turned over in Rule 29 or create fancy appellate law. We want to have a straightforward prosecution and hopefully a guilty plea and uncontroversial jury instructions and a strategically sound prosecution. Secondly, we do things all the time designed not to be in the newspaper. We don't just look for publicity. I've had cases where the department, strictly on the basis of doing the right thing, kept cases out of the news because it was the best result for a victim, the best result for criminal justice. I am deeply proud to work for the Department of Justice. Third is a question for the professor.
I assume that you were getting around to me with those two comments.
Isn't everything you just said structurally about how you should leave states to their own devices? Couldn't all of those arguments be applied to civil rights prosecutions also, where, for instance, local law enforcement is harming or killing or stealing from the local population?
Well, you may have noticed in the Constitution we do have some particular constitutional amendments that address the issue of civil rights, et cetera, that came after the Civil War.
That's not my question, Professor. Wait, my question is...
Could I answer your question?
Yeah.
You're throwing out a red herring in terms of civil rights, which deals with a different issue. My point is you can't simply say this is a bad guy, we're going to get him for something. My point is you have to look at each particular statute and the statute you use. Now, to correct a couple of things that you said before that, you suggested that I was saying you wanted to be in the newspapers. You didn't understand my point. My point was that when something gets in the newspaper, that is immediately targeted. That's a different point from the point you thought I was making. I have no doubt that prosecutors would like to do things in a straightforward fashion. Part of the problem is that the statutes are not straightforward. Part of the problem is with Congress. But the point is that it should go back to Congress. It should not be left to prosecutors and judges to rewrite badly written laws. Again, as Judge Noonan said, the issues related to corruption were never properly defined in this country, and that prosecutors and the justice and the judges took it upon themselves to decide what constitutes corruption. I suggest to you that the term is not self-defining, and that in order to give proper notice to people in a country that has different views on what is and is not proper relationships politically, that this has to be debated and decided in legislative bodies where the statutes are clear, they give notice to everyone. And again, I come back to the voting point. In states where we don't have, where we have one-party rule or whatever when we had it, if you look in those states, you will find that there are voting irregularities. And all of the concerns that people are worried about, if we protect the most fundamental of rights, the right to vote, you will find that people themselves can do a lot to create and correct the corruption problems.
Dan or Bob, do you want to respond?
No.
Okay.
Well, since you're talking about bribery, I'm from Mississippi.
We're going to hear from every state in the here.
Well, you talked about Louisiana. You missed Mississippi. Thank you. What John was just talking about, different cultures have different views of corruption. We have a prosecutor in Mississippi, a statewide elected official, who literally said in the Scruggs bribery matter that he couldn't prosecute these people, even though some of them have admitted it, because they're his friends and contributors, and that would be a conflict of interest. And what was astounding is it seems that most of the public agrees. Because we have such a long history of the feds coming in to clean up the messes we make. Is it a practice within the Department of Justice to go offer prosecutions to local prosecutors before you do it yourselves, and might that be a good practice?
This is definitely a question for Alex.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of cooperation and discussion that goes back and forth. I mean, those cases come to us often from the state level.
Came to us.
Oh, thank you. From the state level, where they would, you know, get in touch with the FBI, the local office of the FBI, and say, we need help here.
Another way to approach the problem is cross-deputizing, where a federal prosecutor prosecutes in state court and state court prosecutor prosecutes in the federal court. If one of the arguments is that the states don't have sufficient resources, that's one of the ways that one could deal with this issue and still respect the state-federal boundaries.
And that happens, too. That happens a lot.
Not enough.
Does that I don't know, that sounds a little bit like detailing people to the Hill. Does that not violate some federalism principle?
No, I'll give you an article about it if you'd like to read it.
Afterwards. Question.
Hi, this is another question for Professor Baker. Earlier you mentioned you thought a solution would be isolating a state, allowing, you know, if the citizens of that state...
My solution is James Madison's solution.
Okay. That if the citizens of the state are willing to put up with this corruption, they should pay the costs until, you know, they figure out how to clean it up. Somebody else mentioned, I think it was Mr. Reedy mentioned, you know, either the responsibility of the government or the ability of the government to protect the individuals in those states who are incapable of responding in that way, and I think you mentioned voter protection as one means. But what about the spillovers of corruption in one state onto other states, for instance, neighboring states or even, you know, a commodities market?
Yes, exactly. In fact, what happened in the Lottery Act was Congress actually got it right. What they said was, back in the 1890s, that Louisiana could sell all the lottery tickets it wanted, but it could not ship them across state lines. In other words, what Congress did was to quarantine Louisiana on lottery tickets. That's your law. It's not unlawful for you to do it in the state. You just can't ship it across state lines. Where we got derailed was the Supreme Court came along and said, you know, lotteries are immoral. This is a good thing that you did in Congress. And Congress then went off and said, and I've quoted the legislative history, well, the Supreme Court has approved our regulating morality, so let's do more of it. And that's how we got into all of this. Congress has every constitutional tool that's necessary to protect other states. And in our federalism, unfortunately, it doesn't do it enough. Because states have lost control over their own borders, it is incumbent upon Congress to make sure that one state doesn't encroach on other states. I wish they'd do it in tort law, for instance. But Congress can confine a state, and that is a legitimate use of the Commerce Clause.
I'm going to ask a follow-up. I was speaking more in terms of, you know, Chicago's got a long history with commodities markets. Louisiana, they used to have a fairly powerful port, the Port of New Orleans. And I mean, you know, when you've got government officials within that state who are corrupt, that's going to affect businesses throughout the whole country. And it seems like you seem to think that if that's only within the state, you know, that state owns that port. You know, if they want to be corrupt over the way they administer that port, that's something that
that's completely wrong. Look, for one thing, the framers were concerned to make sure that the federal government not only had jurisdiction over admiralty, but they had over inland maritime. They were very concerned that ports not be controlled like they are in some other countries by organized groups that block the ports. All I'm saying, you're giving particular examples, and that's good, but each particular example requires a particular statute. And there is every ability in the federal government to deal with the port issues. Anything that crosses a state border, if it is properly, the statute is properly drafted, you can deal with the issue. I come back again and again. What the federal prosecutors love to use is mail and wire fraud statute for everything. It doesn't fit a lot of the things, and indeed, they've obliterated the meaning of fraud. That's the problem.
Sir. Hi, Eric Hasso from New Jersey, another state.
Eric.
Hi, John. I just want to make a point that in our state, we've had U.S. Attorney Chris Christie for the last 7 years, and he, along with Alice Fisher in the criminal division, have overseen the prosecution of, Michael Chertoff before her, Chris Ray, but overseen the prosecution of a number of individuals, and in every single case, I think it's fair to say, public corruption of cases, I think it's fair to say that the defense lawyers say, this is just the way they do business, there was no quid pro quo. We had a mayor of Newark who was recently convicted basically by giving her his mistress, personally authorizing her to get houses that were being renovated and taken out of abandonment to be spruced up and basically approving her to buy them for $5,000 and then she'd flip them for $100,000. And, well, there's no quid pro quo because she would have had sex with him anyway. I mean, that literally was the argument, okay? And so it's not that these arguments aren't made, but the track record is, I think, as of last week, 151 convictions and no acquittals, okay? So I don't think it's a matter of stretching the boundaries where there is corruption that is, on its face, a quid pro quo, and corrupt. And when you have a situation like in New Jersey where, you say, John, that the state should sort of self-regulate itself and that eventually the bums will be kicked out. Well, that's fine in theory, but when you have party bosses who put up the people, okay, to run for office, those are the choices that essentially the one-party state and the party bosses put up those people, go ahead and vote them in. Not going to work. Okay?
Eric, do you think that there is voter fraud in New Jersey?
Absolutely.
Okay, so if in fact all the resources or most of the resources were focused on making sure that there were clean elections, do you think there might be some difference in the politics of New Jersey?
I think in Chicago, in most of the years that I was there, you could have kept vote fraud, which existed in Chicago, completely out of the system, and the machine would have been reelected again and again and again. They did vote fraud because they could, because they basically ran the polling places and everything else. They didn't do vote fraud because they needed to, not in a local election.
All right, so here you get to both ask and answer your own question.
Yes. Thank you. I think that's fair to say, though. Thanks.
All right, do we have any more questioners? All right, do we have any final comments of the panel?
Thank you, Judge.
You're very welcome. In that case, we're going to get out in time for the clearing of the room. So thank you all very much for coming.
Nice to meet you.